We have been living on bread for 10,000 years, but now, of a sudden, we seem to be becoming intolerant of our staff of life. And so we ask, are we running ourselves out of bread?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,185th edition of the Food Chain. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Paphos who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, there is a very good reason they call wheat the staff of life. The grain at the top of that staff is the fuel that propelled us through 10,000 years of civilization. There were most certainly other things for us to eat along the way, but none were quite so manageable as wheat. It gave us the ability to hunker down in one or two places and develop that civilization. Now, the Olson family was raised on Montana winter wheat, and when it comes to wheat, Montana wheat is among the best of the best, at least I think. Mrs. Olson used that wheat to hand make breads and noodle dishes to feed her hoard, and with that food, we Olson children grew up healthy and strong. But somehow, somewhere along the line, something went wrong, because today all of the Olson daughters are intolerant of Montana wheat, and they are not alone in their intolerance. That native children of the Big Sky country of Montana are becoming intolerant of the wheat grown beneath those big skies leads us to ask, are we running ourselves out of bread? Who better to ask than Bob Quinn, who is the CEO of Kamut International and the author of Grain by Grain. Bob, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be here.
Well, pleasure to have you aboard. A wheat and cattle rancher. Are you a cattle rancher as well as wheat up there?
Well, I was a wheat farmer for most of my life and a cattle rancher for the first half, I guess you'd say.
Okay.
When I started traveling, I had to sell out my cows as my wife told me she wasn't going to stay home and feed them in the winter as I traveled around and peddled my grain and business interests.
And they don't travel so well, do they, those cows?
No, they pretty well stick at home and you've got to take care of them.
That's so right. Well, good. So you're all, your family's been in the ranching and the farming business quite a while up there, right?
About 100 years. Next year we'll celebrate our 100th anniversary of our farm that my grandfather started in 1920.
Big Sandy, Montana, correct?
Yes. We're about 12 and a half miles southeast of town, mm-hmm. on the road to Lewistown, if you know the lay of the land in Montana. We're in the north central part of the state, about 80 miles or so from the Canadian border.
And that is wheat country, isn't it?
It is. We're in the western side of the Golden Triangle, which entails most of north central Montana, where some of the best, highest protein wheat in the country is raised.
And what is it about those big skies that grow such good wheat over the years? Do you have any idea? I mean, I'm sure you've thought about it.
Well, I think we're in a semi-arid condition, as you well know. Growing up here, we have about 12 to 14 inches of rainfall a year, so our wheat is normally under stress. And when anything is under stress, it performs the best it can, and sometimes a little better than if you just hand it all you need. And so what's happened to our protein is it makes the grain quite high in protein when the plants don't have enough to just grow all kinds of foliage. They put their energy into to reproducing and making seeds, and those are very high-quality seeds. The other thing that we have advantage over Kansas is cool nights. And it happens that the way the metabolism of the wheat plant works, it changes the protein's laid down if you have hot nights or compared to cold nights. And mm-hmm. the cool nights, they're not cold, it's cool in the summer here, and that does increase the quality of the protein that what the bread makers tell us.
Good, and there you are. Well, you've lived under the big skies for quite a while. How would you describe them to somebody who hasn't been in the big skies of Montana?
Well, you can see your neighbors coming from a long way off.
A long way off, right?
We live on the prairie. We're between the Missouri River and the Bear Paw Mountains, which are about 10 miles away from each other. And from our we live on a little knoll on the prairie, and from that little knoll we can see four other isolated mountain ranges, some of them are as far as 200 miles away. So between us and those little isolated mountain ranges, it's just flat prairie, and it's wide open spaces, and hence you really get a feeling for the big sky because there isn't any mountains or trees or forests. The prairies have no trees, so there's nothing to interrupt the view but grassland.
And speaking of interrupt, you are quite an interrupter yourself with respect to Montana agriculture. And, you know, you went away and studied, and you came back to Montana, and you became one of the first organic farmers in Montana. Now, I got to ask, knowing Montana farmers as I do, what did they say when you brought that notion back to Montana and said, I am going to be an organic farmer?
Well, I came, Michael, from being in California for about 7 years, and they were sure I'd been in California too long. So that was the first comment.
There you go.
And the second comment was, well, they were betting among themselves at the coffee shop, is he going to give up first or is he going to go broke first? Mm-hmm. And, of course, neither happened. And so both sides lost that bet. But that was pretty much my introduction with my neighbors about it.
There, for sure, somebody who's been studying in California, the UC Davis, for all that time is bound to be in trouble up here under the big sky, for sure. Now, when I say interrupt, you have been a substantial interruption to the way of things up in Montana. You've brought new ways of growing crops. You brought new crops, and you've brought new ways of thinking, all to a place that tends to be very set in its ways. So one day, somehow, someplace along the line, an apple fell on top of your head, and you decided that things aren't going to work the way they're working, so we have to change them. Do you remember the occasion of that epiphany?
Well,
something about peaches, epiphany, but... maybe? Something about peaches?
Yeah. I did try some peaches. That's a whole other story. But yeah. When I got back to the farm, it was about 2,400 acres, an average-sized farm for Montana, but it's really only big enough for one to support one family comfortably. And now we had two families. My parents were still on the farm, and my family and I had moved back. And I really was searching around for some way to augment our income. I didn't want to go to town and get a job like a lot of other of my neighbors were having to do this to supplement their farm income because everybody was under a squeeze. They really were. And with two families on one farm, we were really getting squeezed. So I stumbled onto a cousin of mine from Southern California who was looking also for an opportunity in business. And I said, why don't you see if you can sell some of my high-protein wheat to whole grain bakers there in Southern California where he lived. And within a week, he called up and had a customer, Food for Life was their name, and they were a whole grain baker near L.A., and they started taking a truckload a week, and we were really on the road to changing our financial situation. So that was the first thing that happened. And that happened about, 5 years after I moved back to the farm. I had tried two or three different little things that didn't pan out at all, but that one really put us into a profitable situation.
What made you think that you could do that? I mean, what was the, you have this wonderful wheat, and why didn't they, weren't they able to access that wheat in California at the time?
Well, they were using it as a, they wanted specifically high protein and the best qualities that they could find. And most of the time, our wheat is just dumped in the grain elevators and hauled to the coast and blended with less wheat of less quality and sold overseas. That's where the bulk of it goes.
So I sense an entrepreneurial spirit here.
Well, all we had to do was isolate what they really wanted, Michael, and give my one of my philosophies is in business that everybody wins, and the other one is to give the customer what they want. And what this customer wanted was something not available in the regular marketplace.
But something so that you had in your grain bins.
That's right. And so by cutting through all the middlemen, we went directly to the end user, who is the bakery, and made a very fine cooperative effort.
And everybody was happy.
They were.
And
that went along fine for about a year, and then our customer asked me if I could find any organic wheat from him or for him, the same kind of quality. And, mm-hmm. and I told him sure, because that's what you do when your customers ask you for things. And since I hung up the phone, I started scratching my head because I didn't even know any organic farmers, and I didn't really even believe in organic at the time. because of the way I've been taught and the way I've been brought up and schooled. And it took me a few weeks to find a couple in the northeast corner of the state, 300 miles away. And when I started meeting organic farmers, that's when my whole attitude, Michael, really started to change.
Ah. What was the difference in an organic farmer and a conventional farmer?
Well, the thing that I noticed right off is the way they talked about their farm. Most of the non-organic farmers were wringing their hands and wondering how they're going to make the government payments stretch as far as they could and what they're going to do. And the price went down and commodity prices were erratic, going up and down all the time, and how they're going to make ends meet with increasing chemical costs and all this sort of stuff. And my organic farmer friends were talking about completely different subjects. They were talking about how their fields were felt softer to their feet when they walked on them, so the tilth was increasing. They talked about growing their own fertilizer. They talked about eliminating herbicides by rotating their crops, and I was very intrigued by all of that.
Wasn't that kind of a heresy?
Oh, yes. Of course. It was going against, completely against the dogma of the day. And, of course, I'm never one who is worried about going against dogma. So I was very intrigued with what they were saying and really wanted to try it for myself.
What did your dad say?
Well, he was very suspect. He was not convinced that this was the way to go. He thought it was completely too risky because there was no, well, we'd seen no neighbors that had done it. We had not seen anybody close up that had success with this. He thought Montana didn't have enough rain to make this work, that maybe they could grow legumes and soybean crops in the Midwest or where they had more rain, but we certainly couldn't do it here. That was his feeling, and then his other concern was where we're going to sell the stuff anyway. And it was only when I took him to a health food show in Anaheim, California, in 86, and thousands of people went by our booth saying, wow, we're really glad you're looking at this organic stuff or providing it. We weren't growing it yet that time. That really changed my dad's whole outlook on it. And he said, well, maybe there is a market for this. That lowers the risk.
That crazy kid of mine.
He let me try 1% of our farm. Our first experiment was 20 acres.
Uh-huh.
And that's how we started. And it was an organic versus a non-organic experiment. And it was a fantastic success. And so that really put us on the road for a conversion of our farm.
And away you go from there. Well, good. Folks, we're talking with Bob Quinn today. And we're talking about, first of all, we're going to find out what exactly happened to our bread. Why are we all of a sudden, I mean, within the past few years, everybody seems to be becoming intolerant of the staff of life. Kind of scary if you think about it, because that staff of life is what carried us 10,000 years through history, enabled us to get control of ourselves, to move into town, to have a different kind of life. It was something we could grow and we could control, but now it seems to be spinning out of control. We have with us Bob Quinn, a man who really knows what's in that staff of life and has a pretty good idea of what is happening to it, so that we are becoming intolerant of it. And this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're going to take a quick break, but we do hope you will stick with us for one very interesting man. Do stay tuned. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour. What's eating what? And I think about a lot of when I was growing up, it's the fresh homemade noodles and breads that my mother used to make. And oh, yes, how we love chowing down on them fresh out of the oven. But something is happening along the lines that we are now becoming intolerant of those wonderful breads and pastas and whatnot. And so we're going to try to see if we can track down and figure out exactly where we went wrong or where we're going wrong with a man who lives it day in and day out. That would be Bob Quinn, of the CEO of Kalmut International and the author of Grain by Grain. Wonderful story. Let's talk a little bit about where we've gone wrong, Bob, and thinking about how we'd go about growing wheat the conventional way with lots of chemicals. And the question I have is, are we really using glyphosate as a harvest desiccant on wheat?
The answer is some people are. And, of course, not everybody, but some people are. And the further north you go, probably the more prevalent it gets because people are wanting to get their grain dried down and killed and be able to be harvested before the snows and the fall rains start. And that's why the use became so popular and is more prevalent now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're the man who's been watching this for a long time, and you're the man who really led a full-scale rebellion against this conventional way of growing crops. Why? Why did you lead that rebellion? What was it about Bob Quinn that said, well, this isn't going to work, so we're going to change it right now?
Well, you know, to be fair, Michael, I didn't really start out with the idea to change the food system. Just as I started into one adventure after another, just one door after another opened to me, and I learned so much going into a new direction, and then another door opened, I went that way. I really didn't have the whole thing planned out from the beginning, but I really was blessed to have opportunities and good friends to help me understand how to make the most of those opportunities. And you're asking about wheat earlier and what the trouble with it is. You know, in studies in America, it's estimated between 12 and 20% of people can no longer eat wheat and feel good about it in their digestive system or whatever. That's almost one in five. That affects almost every family that's getting very high. And a lot of people say, well, it's just the gluten, and they just go for gluten-free, wheat-free, and they think that's going to be the solution. But I think there's a lot more to the story than just gluten.
And you've tracked that down in laboratories in Italy.
Yes. I have three main areas I think that we're going wrong in our production of food. And, of course, I'm focusing on wheat because it's what I know best. And the first is how we grow it. So our industrial agricultural model compared to sustainable, organic, regenerative models that were used for 10,000 years that were really that's really conventional agriculture. Our chemical experiment of the last 80 years is certainly not conventional at all. I call that an experiment, and we're starting to see now some pretty negative results of that experiment. But the second area then is what's happened in processing, and both in milling and particularly in bakeries, and how they've industrialized also and changed the way they bake, and it's also changed the effect that it has on the final product, the bread or the pasta or whatever. And then, of course, the biggest effect of the change that's happened is in the laboratory where the plant breeders have bred wheat and changed wheat to the benefit of both those other two groups, the farmers and the bakers. And those three things together, I'm convinced, have come together to create a perfect storm where more and more people now cannot digest and enjoy the staff of life, as you were referring to earlier.
Well, take us into the laboratory work that you conducted over there in Italy with some pasta people who had similar interest in you. What's going on with our pasta? What did you find when you started testing wheat? What did you find?
Well, what we ended up doing is we were introduced to an ancient grain that had reportedly come out of the tombs of Egypt. We found that wasn't really true, but it had been around for thousands of years and had not ever been modified by breeding because it was low yielding of not of interest to plant breeders and to commercial production. So it always remained kind of a backyard thing. People grew it in the Mideast because they liked the taste of it, and they grew it for their families mostly, and sometimes local markets, but it was never commercialized. And so we got a hold of that. We started growing it, and one of the first surprises we had was a lady who said she couldn't eat wheat at all and yet had no trouble eating our ancient grain. And so because of that, we decided to register a trademark, which was Kamut. It's from an ancient Egyptian language. It means wheat in the ancient Egyptian language, because at that time we thought it was coming from Egypt, but we found later it was really originally in Mesopotamia. But we started growing this, and I really wondered, because of my scientific background and my training, I really wanted to do some studies and understand what the difference was between modern wheat and ancient wheat. I couldn't find anybody in America who was really interested in helping me. They thought that if people were having trouble eating wheat, it was all in their head. This is about 20 years ago. And they said that all wheat has gluten, and they'd be wasting their time and my money if they did a project such as I was suggesting. But in Italy, I found a very different attitude. people there weren't satisfied with the it wasn't a solution at all. It was a kind of a Band-Aid approach so common in America that if they couldn't eat something, they just avoid it and eat something else rather than trying to understand what the original problem is. In Italy, they really wanted to understand more what the original problem was and what the mode of actions were. And so we started financing through our Kamut project. We became quite successful in selling it in this ancient Greek in Italy. With the profits, we used some of those profits to finance research studies at University of Bologna and University of Florence. We found, by and large, well, almost totally, with all of our research studies, that people who ate ancient wheat compared to modern wheat had a great reduction in inflammation. And once we saw that, we started studying chronic disease, because chronic disease is tied to inflammation. So we studied heart disease, irritable bowel syndrome, non-alcoholic fatty liver syndrome, diabetes, and even fibromyalgia. And in all these studies, we found a remarkable decrease in cholesterol, blood sugar, insulin resistance. We found an increase in antioxidant capacity, so it had more antioxidant resources. And then the biggest difference, about 30 to 45% difference, was this inflammatory response. And that was quite amazing to us.
That's a huge percentage.
It's huge. And people can actually feel it, particularly those who were the irritable bowel syndrome test, because they can actually feel the difference when they eat things that aggravate their digestive system.
What about celiac disease?
Well, that is really technically an intolerance to gluten, and that's about 1% of the population. And that can affect some people so seriously that it can be life and death. So we don't really experiment with those kind of people.
Right, okay. So we set aside the celiac disease, but that leaves the intolerance.
Right, and the wheat sensitivities is called now, too. A broader term now is just wheat sensitivity, and it takes in all kinds of problems other than celiac. So it's non-celiac wheat sensitivity is how it's being referred to as all the other problems that people have with wheat. And that's about 19% or so of the population.
And away we go. So that's hugely significant as well, 19%, 1 in 5. Man.
Yep. And some people think that celiac could be prevented if we were eating wheat that was less, harsh on the system. Mm-hmm. And so even though there's some debate, and some people think it can be reversed, but that's a little bit tricky, and we haven't studied that ourselves. But many people think it can be prevented so that we might reverse that trend, and that would be a big help to a lot of people.
So there's a harshness about modern wheat that's getting to us. Have we defined that harshness?
Well, most of it has come, a small there's a, probably the greatest part of that has come with the change of the gluten. The gluten has been made to be more elastic so it can hold more air, so the bakers can produce more bread with less wheat, because they're now making more air bread. There's more air in their loaves.
Air bread, you call it.
Yes. The great American white air bread, yes.
Okay, Wonder Bread.
That kind of thing.
So they changed, how did they change the gluten? Did they re-engineer the plant?
In breeding programs, they just selected for gluten that would produce bigger loaf volumes in their bake tests. And they were able to select for bigger and bigger loaf volumes, which really was connected directly to the gluten strength and how the gluten worked. And for many people, it was hard to digest that gluten. But that's not the whole story. The rest of the story, there's two other parts. One of it is the bakeries going to fast-rising yeast, which only has time now. They raise the bread so fast that it only has time to digest the sugar, convert the sugar that they add to the dough to the carbon dioxide, which raises the bread and puts gas in the bread, and then they pop it in the oven. And if you compare that with long fermentations, particularly sourdough, I don't know if you know, Michael, but research coming out of Colorado suggests that sourdough fermentations of 48 hours will destroy 97% of all the gluten in the bread.
Wow.
When you're digesting it like that, it's pre-digested is what it is.
And that takes care of a lot of the problems then.
It would. For people who are really having a gluten problem, that would make all the difference in the world. And then if you use a a heritage wheat or an ancient wheat, at least the wheats that haven't been bred for these modern factors or goals, then you're stacking the deck again in your favor. And if you add longer fermentations to that, it might be all you need to be back to eating bread again.
And so Bob Quinn's got a pretty good notion that the real problem is just modern times diseases, right?
That's right. And you mentioned glyphosate early on, and now with more glyphosate showing up in our food, that glyphosate not only kills weeds, but it also kills bacteria.
Right.
It doesn't really, the debate goes on if it harms human cells. It doesn't seem to be so directly harmful, but it certainly is destroying some bacteria. And if you look at the bacteria that we have in our body, the number of bacteria in our gut exceeds the number of human cells in our whole body. So it's a huge, huge population. And if you start affecting that, you start affecting your digestion right away. And that can mimic many of what people are calling wheat sensitivity symptoms. It's really nothing more than glyphosate sensitivities.
You know, I'm beginning to think that we human beings are really like the Amazon jungle walking down the street. We have so many, there's so much of us that nobody, we don't think about, but it's incredible. And those things are vulnerable just like the rest of us are, I guess. So Bob Quinn up there in Montana is looking at this situation, and he's experimenting with ancient grains. And you call it your grain, Kamut International, and a good indication of your entrepreneurship is that you went out and got a trade name on that. You own it.
Well, we registered the trademark, so we don't own the grain. The grain is a gift from the creator himself and for our benefit, and I don't think people should own that kind of life. But the trademark is used to make certain guarantees to our customers.
Right.
And it doesn't mean we control the wheat, but we control the qualities under which that wheat is sold if it uses the Kamut trademark. And the qualities that we promise and it guarantees that it's always raised organically. It's always ancient wheat, never mixed with modern wheat. It's always high protein and high in minerals. And we don't let any of our customers who make their own products with it and use the trademark tell any untruths or pretend it's not wheat or pretend it doesn't have gluten. That's not true. Or any claims that they make must be substantiated by research, published research.
Good. So one of the tough things in the world to do is to get somebody to eat something new. You can see this in a little child who hasn't experimented. You know, they look at something and, did my mama teach me to eat this? No. So this guy over here in Montana is saying I should eat this ancient grains. How did you convince the world to eat ancient grains?
Well, we just gave it to them in forms they would recognize, like bread and pasta and crackers and cookies, and the taste sold itself. And particularly when we
got What does it taste like?
It's a little bit more nutty and than regular wheat. And, you know, red wheats have a, especially if you're looking at whole wheats, have a little bit of a bitter aftertaste because of the tannins in the bran. This Khorasan grain that we market under the Kamut trademark it's a very close relative of durum, and it doesn't have those, it's not a red wheat, it's more like a durum wheat, and it doesn't have those bitter aftertastes. And so you're eliminating the need for sugar to cover that up, and it has a very nice flavor all of its own that really stands out.
And there you go. So taste this. Now, are you able to get the intolerant people to taste it, and what happens when they taste it?
Well, that's an interesting question, Michael, because the people that really are wheat sensitive, you know, a lot of people, up to 40% now, dabble with wheat-free, gluten-free. And I can always tell at food shows those people who are doing it because it's in vogue or it's something they can brag about at the cocktail party or something, because when they say we have an ancient wheat, they say, oh, no, wheat, we can't eat wheat, we don't eat wheat, and they turn up their nose and they just keep prancing down the aisles. But the people who are really sensitive to it, they would love to be able to eat wheat again.
Oh, yes.
And they're anxious to try it. They said, really, are you sure? Can we really think we can eat this? And well, according to our research, 85% of the people with any kind, even most harshest of sensitivities, have no trouble eating this. Of course, we don't know who the 15% are, so we said, you know, just take it easy. and just try a little bit.
Try a little bit and see what happens.
Yeah.
Okay.
But most of them can tell within a couple hours.
There you go.
They're back, and the majority are back, and they're excited.
Good for them, and good for you. Folks, are we running out of bread? Is it possible? Are we, through our modern technologies, are we destroying bread? Well, Bob Quinn has a way of serving us up some bread that we won't destroy ourselves on. So do stay tuned. We will be right back with The Food Chain.
So little time to say it on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, we are up in Big Sandy, Montana. What's it like up there when you look out your window today, Bob? Give us a quick...
Well, we had snow yesterday, so...
Welcome to Montana, folks.
First of May, yeah, we've got snow drifts that are still waiting to be melted, and they are going down because, you know, this time of year the sun is pretty high in the sky and the days are longer, but we had two Sundays in a row with snowstorms. Last week we had a 5-foot drift in our yard, and this last Sunday we had 3 or 4 inches that covered everything. So we're having a little hard time getting into spring. Our trees haven't budded out yet, and the roses and bushes are just barely starting to bud, and some of the pretty tulips are up, and that's it. We're slow.
What about lilacs?
They're just barely budding.
Ugh. Okay, when they do come out, you'll rejoice, I'm sure, because that's the true sign of spring right there.
It is, yeah.
Well, some time ago on the Food Chain Radio program, I did a radio show live from the hamburger farm in South Dakota. And it was an amazing place. They grew corn and soy and on thousands and thousands of thousands of acres. And the first thing they did was they invited me into their office, which was on the second deck of their home on top of a hill, kind of like yours is, I suspect. And from their office, you could look out and see crops growing as far as you could possibly see, and the office reminded me of the deck of an aircraft carrier, you know, and there was all of these instruments and everything in it, and looking out over the ocean of crops, and I thought, you know, this is truly amazing that we have these technologies now that can allow for this kind of production, you know. A farmer and his wife and some tractors and maybe an occasional hand here and there, but they were pretty much doing it all by themselves with the help of that technology, the equipment and the chemicals. And then after I conducted the interview, I went into town, a small town there in South Dakota, and it was like a ghost town. And and they were having their crazy days sale, you know, the merchants put stuff out on the sidewalk, and so I stopped, and there were some Boy Scouts selling hot dogs there, and so I got a hot dog and a soft drink, and I said, how's business? And they said, well, you're the first person to stop by today. And you know, we've essentially emptied out the countryside, and you're bringing it back. How the hell are you doing that?
Well, I tell people, anyone who wants to listen to me, that there's a very, very high cost of cheap food. And the highest cost starts right at the farm gate, where people aren't given enough to make a living anymore because of the cheap commodity mentality and the way that the markets are set up. So half of the farmers in my neighborhood aren't here anymore. The people paying the high cost of cheap food are the small communities, just like you described. My little town of Big Sandy has gone from 1,000 to 600, and a lot of Main Street businesses aren't there anymore because the farmers aren't there to support them. And it's just a kind of a race to the bottom. Yeah. And the next high cost is paid by our earth with all the pollutions that we have now with agricultural chemicals because they don't stay where you put them. And now we have dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico. We have glyphosate in our rain, for heaven's sakes, that falls on our land. We have it in the soil. We have it in the surface water and groundwater. It's not the only chemical there. Lots of other chemicals are there, too. And then the very last but the greatest high cost is to our health. And the chronic diseases that's on the rise now is going to be a bill that pretty soon we will not be able to pay, no matter what kind of insurance program we come up with in this country. If a The high percent of the people are chronically ill. No country can support that. And that's where we're headed. And so that's the high cost of cheap food.
Well, you know, having done about 1,200 of these food chain radio programs, what's eating what, a long time ago I came to the conclusion that there are, you know, trends I see in the storylines. And I just turned them into Michael Olson's three laws of the food chain. And the third law is cheap food isn't. And I'm wondering, yeah. I'm wondering if you ever found something that would disagree with that law of the food chain. Is there anything that is cheap?
Is there anything that's cheap?
Yes.
And you don't pay later, you mean?
Yes. I mean, when you add up all the costs, is there anything that's cheap when it comes to food?
Eventually, the full cost will have to be paid. And what people are getting fooled is the cost that they pay at the checkout counter. That's just a fraction of the cost of the food. And that's what we really have to start to understand. What we're trying to do is grow good food. And we don't grow a single commodity on our whole farm. We don't grow wheat commodities. We grow nutritious.
That's an excellent point that I wanted to pick up. What the heck is a commodity?
Yeah, well, that's a newfangled way of thinking. It's an industrialization of our agriculture. It's a new way of thinking that commoditizes. We don't even grow food anymore. We grow commodities, something that's bought and sold and traded on commodity exchanges. And we don't even, farmers a lot of times don't even think about the fact that they're growing food. They're growing commodities as cheap as possible and as plentiful as possible. So we have lots of food. We have an abundance of food in this country. And I tell people, I think that we're very well fed in America by and large, but we're not very well nourished. And that's the difference. And that doesn't fit into the industrial model.
And that industrial model being whoever can grow the most for the least wins.
Yeah, right.
So now you obviously came to the conclusion that that's not a way to go about doing business. And
no, right.
And so away goes Bob Quinn. What on earth are you doing up there?
So the first thing we did, I already mentioned, is cutting out all the middlemen and selling the very highest quality that we can grow to the people that appreciate it the most, the bakers that are putting it into high quality end products of their own. And that was a real eye-opener to me, and that's got me thinking about what we're doing. And then the next thing, when we changed to organic agriculture, I found that was even worth even more. People were willing to pay more for organic because the nutrition was better.
And it doesn't have any chemicals.
Pesticides.
Yeah.
Right, they didn't have to worry about residues. So that added more value. So what we're trying to do is add more and more value to our farm production, which stays right in the community. And we don't have to get bigger and bigger farms to survive on lower and lower margins, but we can bring actually more and more people back to the country because there's more enterprise now. We're growing vegetables on dry land, which the neighbors again said you couldn't do, but we're working out ways that it can be successful, and we're having a lot of support by the local communities that really enjoy locally grown vegetables, which is really almost an unheard of in Montana.
Well, unless you were raised on a Montana farm and remember those
ago.
and remember those giant kitchen gardens. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And they mostly have disappeared. You know, farmers that are growing these tens of thousands of acres you've mentioned, they don't have time to have gardens anymore. So they have bought into the cheap food thing. They go to town and get cheap food instead of growing something that's really nutritious. It maybe takes a little more time and investment, but investment is well worth it on their health. And the enjoyment of the meals.
Well, how many enterprises have you started up there, Bob Quinn?
Well, one of the next big ones we did was start to grow our own fuel, which turned into actually growing a high oleic safflower plant that we crushed on our farm. So we bought some oil presses, and we pressed that oil, and we found that was much more valuable as a food than dumping it in our tractors right away. So we first sell it to restaurants and large kitchens at the universities, and then we bring back that oil, the used oil, and we clean that up and filter it and take the water out, and we put that in our tractor. So we actually use it twice and sell it twice, and that works out very well for us.
Well, yeah, when you sell anything twice, it's going to work out than selling it once, I suspect. Yeah.
That's right.
What is about safflower oil?
You have to be careful that you're looking for high oleic. Oleic acid is a monounsaturated, which means it only has one double bond, and it's very, very stable, and it's the best kind of oil for high-temperature cooking. So this oil is actually healthier than olive oil and is more versatile particularly for high-temperature cooking. And because it's so stable, it has a longer shelf life and also longer cooking life before it has to be discarded. And that, even though it's a little more expensive to the users because they can use it longer, that investment, much of that higher investment is recouped because it lasts longer than cheap oils.
Mm-hmm. And what other enterprises? This is like shopping almost.
Yeah. Well, the most recent thing that we've done that's really a lot of fun is take our ancient grain, which is about three times the size of modern wheat, and we soak it, and then we roast it in our high oleic safflower oil, put a little salt on, and we sell it as a wheat snack called Crackling Kamut. And it's really a lot of fun to eat. There's no sugars in it or anything like that. It's just three ingredients, salt, the oil, and the wheat. And we've just getting started with that, but we've had a lot of very positive feedback on it. And we're doing that right here in our local town of Big Sandy. So we've been able to increase between the different enterprises we have going with the farm vegetables and the little orchard I have and the bringing more people in to run the farm because it takes more help with organic agriculture. Mm-hmm. We've been able to increase the population of Big Sandy by about almost 4%. But they all have kids in the high school or in the school population. By the time their kids are in school, will be increased about 15%. So that's starting to be a very significant contribution.
And people with something fun and good to do. You know, I did a radio show from the Standing Rock Reservation in South Dakota. The show was about the Sioux buffalo herd. And while waiting for my guest to show up at our rendezvous, which was a little convenience store on the reservation there, I was looking for something to eat, and you know what that's like, looking for something to eat in a convenience store. And I was standing there staring at the jerky when I realized that the jerky was all made in Los Angeles.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And here we have the great Sioux reservation and the buffalo herd. And I think what the Sioux need is Bob Quinn to go teach them on some entrepreneurship on how to make Sioux buffalo jerky and sell it in Los Angeles.
Well, I think that's right. And I'm working here with the Rocky Boy Reservation. It's right near us. And so far we helped them. I helped them transfer or change it 400 acres of their multi. They have 10,000 acre farm. 400 acres have been converted to organic, and on that they're growing the Kamut ancient wheat because it's really good for diabetes, and the diabetes is rampant. Now we have a flour mill ordered, and we'll soon have that installed so that they can start raising, grinding, and preparing their own food that they raise right in the reservation. It's much better for them than the commodity programs that bring in white sugar and white flour to them, which are just like poison to diabetics.
Amen. Now, to what extent are you infecting Montana with
well,
Bob Quinnism?
It's just not me. We have a lot of helpers now, and there's a lot of other people that have started to do similar things, and I'm really excited about that kind of progress. We've got a neighbor down the road that raises cantaloupes right near the Missouri River or on the Missouri River, and they let them vine ripen, and when they come to town, they sell probably three times higher than the tasteless green cantaloupes coming in from California, but they fill the store with aroma of ripe cantaloupe. Yep. And people come in just by the hordes, and they don't care what they cost. They're so good and delicious. And those are the kinds of things that we really need to promote and to support. And it's starting to happen more and more.
And how do you encourage that growth and development of that ideal? Do you do a lot of public speaking? I bet you do.
Yeah, quite a bit. And I always take samples so people can taste and see for their own self and how it tastes and what it looks like. Because, you know, we've had to fight against a lot of old wise tales about how bad organic food was in the beginning and then it was spoiled and was rotten and all this other stuff. And that doesn't exist anymore. The grocery stores now, by and large, have almost all of them have organic sections. Organic production, organic sales of food in America now is over 5%, maybe 5.5% or so, and it's growing almost 10% a year. So if that rate keeps up, in another 30 years, we'll be 100% organic. That's what I'm excited about.
Who's the enemy?
Well, the entrenched people who want nothing changed because they're making a lot of money the way it is now, and that's the agrochemical industry on the one hand and big pharma on the other. That doesn't care that a lot of people have chronic diseases because they've got a pill for everything and they're glad to sell it to you. So they don't really want people thinking about food as medicine because they want to sell their pills as medicine. So you got two giant ends of the spectrum. They're kind of working us toward the middle, extracting all the profits and all the money they can out of rural America and now out of urban America.
They do make a good enemy, don't you think?
Well, I guess. I really don't go head to head with those kind of guys. I just provide people with ideas of alternatives that can be better for them. And in a system where everybody wins, this is what we need. We don't need just one faction of the economy to win, like the agrochemical, multinational companies and the big pharma. We need everybody to win. And we can do that with organic agriculture, with minimum processing, and with more local.
Listen, rumor has it you're coming to Santa Cruz. True?
I am. Be there, next week now.
Okay. Look for Bob Quinn coming to Santa Cruz. Start a revolution. Thank you all so much
14th.
For joining us. Thank you.
14th
of May. Thank you so much, Bob Quinn.
Jane Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.